When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Anfield.
Hello and welcome to the latest episodes of Analyzing Anfield from the Liverpool Echo. I'm Beth Lindop. I'm joined by Kiefer MacDonald, a slightly different hosting lineup perhaps than you used to on this podcast, but we will do our best over the next few months to try and unpick all the tactical talking points and big news from inside Anfield in what could well prove to be a very exciting few months for the club as well, Kiefer. Now it is transfer deadline day, so on today's podcast we will be assessing Liverpool's January transfer business or lack thereof, and assessing whether we think they've got enough to carry them till the end of the season. We'll also be looking at potential successes for Jurgen Klopp. Very big shoes to fill, I think we all agree. But before that, we have to start with Liverpool's 4-1 victory over Chelsea last night. I mean, Kiefer, they were just phenomenal, weren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I said after the game that I think we've been waiting for a kind of a statement performance from Liverpool for so long this season. You can maybe argue that they've done it kind of in halves or patches or final 30 minutes, whatnot. And maybe the Newcastle game on New Year's Day was as close as we've had to kind of a complete performance. But last night, from minute one to minute 90, they're absolutely brilliant to a man. I mean, you know, Chelsea haven't had the best of seasons, but, you know, leading into the game, they've found a bit of form. I think, you know, only four teams in the Premier League have taken more points from them than them over the last six games. So, you know, they were quietly on the up under Pochettino. And it's a squad that's, you know, let's not forget, got £200 million plus midfielders in Enzo Fernandez and Moises Caicedo. And Liverpool, just as I say, to a man, were absolutely brilliant. All the goals were phenomenal. I mean, starting off with Jota, he was just... kind of summed up him and how important he's been to Liverpool in recent
months. It was a prime Diogo Jota goal, wasn't it last night?
It was really good. And Theo actually said to me at the game last night, it was kind of Suarez-esque in terms of like a lucky deflection. But then when that deflection does break, he kind of holds his nerve, waits for the goalkeeper to dive and kind of slots it home. And that really set the tempo for Liverpool after, 15, 20 minutes. And from there, Chelsea never really looked like, you know, testing Liverpool. I mean, I don't think Alisson had anything to do during the game. I mean, he might as well have been sat on the cop with the rest of the Liverpool supporters. But I mean, considering the news that Liverpool had last week, obviously the shock announcement that Klopp would be leaving. I think it was a real tonic that last night, wasn't it? And I think it made everyone kind of buckle up and strap in for these next couple of months, which could prove, as you said at the top of the show, Beth, you know, just they could be magical, couldn't they? A really good way to end his reign. But I mean, obviously we'll touch on Conor Bradley. I don't know what you thought of his performance. I mean, if, as I say, so many good performers, but I think he was the pick of the bunch. He kind of had that fairy tale night at Anfield, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. I was totally blown away, to be honest. I mean, I've been so impressed by him in recent weeks. He's been phenomenal. I think that's three Man of the Match awards he's won over the past few weeks as well. And, you know, I think coming into this season, it sort of felt like he was going to be the Trent backup. And, you know, I've had my reservations at times about Liverpool's decision not to bolster the defensive ranks in the summer and obviously in January, but with the emergence of Jurel Quantzer and now the form that Bradley is showcasing, you can understand, can't you, why the manager and his staff have decided to put faith in Conor Bradley. And just looking at some of his stats here from last night, I mean, 63 touches, one goal, two assists, four key passes, three tackles, a 9.4 SofaScore rating. And I know those ratings don't always necessarily reflect how they perform on the pitch, but last night he was just phenomenal. And I think what I loved about him, there was a guy sat behind me in the main stand, and at one point he said, the thing I love about this kid is he always wants the ball, he's always asking for it. And that's all you can ask from a young player, isn't it? That confidence to be able to just get on the ball, and he knows exactly where to be, he knows when to take risks, but he also knows as well, which I think is maybe something that he's learned a little bit in League One, when to play it a little bit safe. And I think there'll be a lot said about his attacking play and how phenomenal he was going forward, but also I think defensively he's no slouch either, is he?
No, absolutely. I mean, you touched on it then, of kind of how forward-thinking he is, and I think that was a takeaway from Sunday's game against Norwich as well. I mean, for Nunez's goal, he dispossesses their left-back on the halfway line, who was really high up, and he plays the ball straight away to Jota, gets it back, and then plays it straight through to Nunez. And in a blink of an eye, Liverpool had gone from defending, you know, their own half to going through on goal. And it was kind of similar last night for Jota's goal, wasn't it? He obviously dispossesses Chilwell, you know, really high and wide, and then straight away he's driving into that space and he makes a difference once again. And as you say, it's I think prior to this season everyone was looking and thinking, who do Liverpool sign who could replace Trent Alexander-Arnold? There was a lot of talk about, you know, if Trent's position was in the middle of the park. But the biggest compliment I could give Conor Bradley is that he's making his own name. He's not a Trent 2.0, so to speak. I mean, if anything, he reminds me more of Robertson, how he prefers to go on the outside. I mean, yeah. I think he's got a nicer touch than Robertson and a more delicate delivery. And I think he's a more complete footballer than Robertson. But I just think the potential for him and Trent on this right-hand side for the next couple of years is really exciting. And it's not come out of nowhere either, because as you say, the pre-season tour, he really impressed on that. And I think the plan was to kind of maybe do this at the start of the season. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he was really unlucky with that back injury and kind of spent a few months on the sidelines. And he's just kind of come alive in this January period where Liverpool really needed him, especially with Trent getting injured, and all of a sudden you're kind of laughing and joking now, saying, you know, what does Trent have to do to get back into this team? So, I mean, it was a really good night for him, a really positive night, and so many in the Liverpool team played really well. I thought McAllister was another one who had probably one of his best games since joining the club. Kind of ironic that it was up against Caicedo, someone he formed such a great partnership with at Brighton last year, and obviously Enzo Fernandez, who he won the World Cup with last year with Argentina. But I mean, he was brilliant to kind of steal the show up against, as I say, £200 million worth of talent. Beth, I thought, you know, brilliant from minute one to 90, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I did think, sort of, you know, when you go back to that first game of the season, you know, Liverpool played at Stamford Bridge, I did think that, you know, McAllister in that holding role looked slightly shaky, and you looked at the quality of Enzo Fernandez at that point. I thought he was probably the standout player on that day, and I think, you know, last night it was sort of almost like a full circle moment playing Chelsea again, and actually it was McAllister who stole the show. And he's one of my favourite players to watch. Yeah. His range of passing is exquisite. I mean, that ball he plays through to Nunez for the assist then to Luis Diaz, and he played one prior to that, I think it was out to Cody Gakpo, and just, he's so smooth, isn't he? Yeah. And so intelligent. I think, you know, I love watching intelligent footballers. It's like that's why everyone of a Liverpool persuasion loved Roberto Firmino so much, wasn't it? Because his IQ as a footballer was second to none. Cody Gakpo, I think, has got that too, but Alexis McAllister is just a brilliant football brain, and that translates to what he does on the pitch. And I think it will be interesting now to see what Liverpool do in midfield, because, you know, as you say, we can all joke and say, well, where does Trent fit in? But really, where does he fit in? What would you do if you were Jurgen Klopp?
Well, thankfully, I'm not Jurgen Klopp. but it's difficult, isn't it? Because we've seen Trent. I don't think he's really started out and out in midfield too many times this season, and certainly not in his Liverpool career. We've mainly seen that with England under Gareth Southgate. But I think it has been interesting at times this season when Liverpool have been pushing for a winner or an equaliser, especially, you know, you think that Fulham game at the start of December when they were 3-2 down and end up winning 4-3, that the kind of the catalyst for that final 30 minutes was Trent going into midfield. I think Gomez comes on, and that kind of changed the dynamic of that game, and Liverpool kind of wrestled a, you know, a grip on the contest, and obviously ultimately, you know, got a massive 3 points. But Klopp's not really done it from the start, and I don't think he's needed to yet, because that kind of does feel, as I say, like his trump card if things aren't going Liverpool's way. But it certainly would be interesting to see him, you know, him and Bradley. The one thing I would kind of query is, would it make Bradley's role, because you look at, like, last night when he has Szoboszlai in front of him and he has a McAllister, you know, he has that kind of protection going the other way. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're kind of putting all the onus on Trent to be the kind of the creative nucleus of the team, and then you've got Bradley there who's kind of, you know, flying up and down the touchline, would you maybe have to rein in Bradley a little bit and just say, you know what, we've got Trent doing this, especially when you've got someone like Salah on that side as well? But I'm sure they can find kind of a happy medium where both of them can kind of really flourish. And it's so exciting because they're both so young. I think, what, Trent's 25 and Bradley's 20. And, you know, Bradley's, what, 2 Premier League appearances, that's now. And as you say, he's got, I think, 2 Man of the Matches in those appearances. So a really exciting time, not just for Jurgen Klopp between now and the end of the season, but whoever does come in and kind of take the hot seat at Liverpool beyond, because it is a really exciting team that Jurgen Klopp has kind of quietly reassembled. You know, he says it a lot this season as a Liverpool 2.0, but it really does feel like that. And I think someone who is going to be key that I think we do have to touch on, Beth, is Darwin Nunez. I mean, I don't think I've done a Liverpool podcast over the last 18 months since he signed where I haven't talked about Darwin Nunez. So we'll continue that theme today. I mean, it was just a crazy night for him. I mean, I can't find the words to sum it up, really, but how did he not score is my first question to you.
He is the unluckiest centre-forward in the history of football, I think, isn't he, really? And I do think if sort of any 90 minutes could encapsulate his Liverpool career so far, it was probably that last night, because I thought he was absolutely phenomenal for most of the first half, just such a nuisance. Had a couple of efforts on goal, decent efforts on goal, drew a really good save from Petrovic in that first half. And it was all going so well until the penalty. And you know, I did see, obviously, McAllister had the ball at first. And I know Liverpool have been doing that for quite a while, haven't they? They've been sort of disguising the penalty taker, protecting them. Mo Salah quite often gets handed the ball right before he goes up to take the penalty. And I do get that. But I did think when I saw McAllister stood on the spot with the ball, I hope he takes it, because, you know,
it just felt like unneeded pressure for Nunez if he was to.
Yeah, of course. He's, you know, I actually didn't realise until after last night that was the first penalties missed in his professional career. I think he'd scored 12 out of 12 prior to that. So that's an impressive record. And you can understand, you know, why he was given the ball. And, you know, you want your centre forward to step up and take that responsibility, don't you? You don't want a number nine shirking away from the responsibility of taking a penalty. So in a lot of ways, I admire him for doing that. But he is, in spite of his good record previously, I would not have him on pens going forward, because he's such an emotional player. Yeah. And I think he feels that weight of expectation on him, you know.
Probably more than most.
Yeah, so I think when you've got some ball strikers in the team that Liverpool have, you know, Dominic Szoboszlai, Alexis McAllister, Trent Alexander-Arnold even, you know, when Mo Salah's not on the pitch, I wouldn't have Nunez taking the pens. But yeah, I thought sort of second half, he sort of dropped off. I think the first sort of 20 minutes of that second half, perhaps that penalty miss was lingering in his head a little bit. He gets a bit of a petulant booking for stopping a quick free kick. But then again, he rallied, and that's why so many Liverpool fans love him, because he doesn't let things phase in for too long. He gets his head straight back up, and then an absolutely sublime assist, wasn't it, for Luis Diaz? It really, really was. And you could see from sort of how vehemently he celebrated after that, it was almost like he'd scored a goal himself. And that's why you will him on, because you know he just wants to do well, and as such, you want him to do well. But I think that the thing is, we're sort of waiting for him to come good almost. We're waiting for him to sort of have that run where he's banging in the goals, you know, every game, and his game sort of becomes a little bit more polished. And actually last night I was thinking, I don't think we're ever really going to get that with him. You know, I know he's still relatively young, 24. Yeah. So, you know, but he's not a kid. And I sort of think this is almost maybe what we're going to get from him. And there will be games where he spurns great opportunities, but there'll also be games where he's phenomenal. And I think more often than not, he'll play a huge part in Liverpool doing well. And so I think ultimately we maybe have to sort of stop being so reactionary when he has a good run of form or when he has a bad run of form. I think that's the sort of player he's going to be for Liverpool.
Absolutely. I mean, I was reading a piece earlier actually, and it kind of highlighted that, you know, for kind of all the big misses that people have pointed out, he's actually probably won Liverpool more points than he's so-called like lost Liverpool. I mean, if you're thinking of big misses, it's probably that one at Luton Town, in the 1-1 where, you know, Salah has the header, I think it is, and then, you know, Nunez kind of skies it from, you know, 4 or 5 yards out. But apart from that, you think of, as I say, the kind of the big goals he scores. He scores the one at Burnley over Christmas, the opener. He scores obviously the two at Newcastle earlier in the season. I know what you mean. I mean, obviously Liverpool paid a lot of money for him, and I think if Klopp was staying in charge for a bit longer, you'd maybe have more kind of understanding in the project. But I think if a new manager is going to come in and put in his ideas on the table, you've really got to look at your number nine and think, you know, which way do I want to go? And as to be fair, I think Liverpool, you know, despite him not getting on the score sheet last night, I think Liverpool are a much better team with him in it. What I really like about the kind of front for 4 or 5 players at the moment is that each of them have something different. I mean, Jota was always a goal poacher, but he's kind of added more to his all-round play, I think, over the last 12, 18 months. Maybe almost kind of helped by that barren run he had last season, he's maybe learned to add different kind of aspects to his game. I think Luis Diaz, we've seen over the last kind of 4, 5, 6 weeks that he's adding, or he's looking more like the Luis Diaz that arrived at Liverpool in January 2022. I think Cody Gakpo is a bit of a connector. he's a bit of the utility man, the James Milner off the forward line, if you like. And then Mo Salah is your undroppable one, isn't he? But Nunes kind of is a bit of a mix of them all, isn't he? He's not obviously got the ruthless streak that Mo Salah has, but I mean the tenacity to kind of wrestle Thiago Silva, as you say, for that. For Diaz's fourth goal last night. I mean, that's, as you say, everything you want to see from your centre forward. And I just think if I was a centre half, and you hear, like, you know, the likes of Carragher and Neville say it, like, you just wouldn't want to be playing against him.
No.
Because how do you stand off him? Do you give him space to run at you? Do you go tight? All right, you stand off him. He's going to touch it down and bring it on the floor. He's capable of playing. You know, he's good in the air. It feels like he has got, as everyone has said for the last kind of 2 years, 18 months, 2 years, whatever, he has got, you know, if you could, you know, make a dream striker, almost, you know, height, speed, physicality. It's just kind of the finishing and the clinical edge that he's lacking him at the moment.
Yeah, but 22 goals and assists, you know, in all competitions so far this season. I mean, in January, that's not a bad return at all.
Really? It's gone under the radar somewhat.
Yeah, and I think it's because I think that's where the frustration is born from sometimes, because you think if he converted even half of the chances that he creates, then he'd be a, you know, 20 goal a season striker in the Premier League alone. And I think there is a chance he gets to that, but like I say, I almost sort of think this is going to be him. I don't think he's ever going to quite be that polished diamond that Erling Haaland is, for example. But still, as you say, 100% agree. I think Liverpool are a far better team when he's playing there as well.
So. I like last night how he, I don't know if you noticed this, but within the first 10 or 15 minutes, he'd already had four or five shots.
Yeah.
It was very much a shoot on sight. Because I think we've seen sometimes he does overthink it, and I think he does get into his own head. As you say, he's an emotional striker, he's an emotional player. And there's been times that, you know, he's won the ball and he's counter-pressed in a really good area, and he's got someone on the edge of the box, and he's got someone at the back post. He kind of gets caught in two minds, and as I say, he doesn't really have that kind of ruthlessness to make a decision and stick to it or pick an area. And he gets dispossessed, he gets his pocket picked. But last night, the two kind of early shots he had, I think the first one, Petrovic tips onto the bar, the second one onto the post. It was just, you know, wins the ball back, you know, touch out his feet and strike. And I really did like that approach, because it was kind of, I think that put Chelsea under an awful lot of pressure as well. And obviously Anfield really got behind Nunes straight away, because it was like, oh my God, he's nearly scored. Mm-hmm. And it was like, Nunes. And that, I think, you know, if you're a Chelsea player in the first 10 or 15 minutes at Anfield, I mean, you listen to anyone who's ever played there, they say you just got to survive, you know, make it to half time, and then you start looking at if you can nick a point, or, you know, nick all 3 points kind of thing. But I think that really helped set the tone for Liverpool last night.
Yeah, definitely. One other thing that I just wanted to touch on briefly from last night's game was the passing of Van Dijk and Konate, because I think Liverpool, there's so much to admire about what they've done this season tactically, and there's so much for opposition to worry about in terms of the threat that Trent brings going into that sort of inverted fullback role, and obviously then the wide players, Mo Salah, as we've touched on there, Darwin Nunes. But then when you think they can set up opposition teams to deal with that, and then you have the ability to bypass completely midfield with Van Dijk and Konate, with the quality of passing that they have. I mean, Van Dijk, that ball that he played through to Conor Bradley to then set up Dominic Szoboszlai for the third goal. And Konate, he could have had about three assists, couldn't he, in the first half an hour. He's turned into sort of prime Beckham, spraying some balls, you know, left, right and centre. So I thought it was really interesting last night, because both of them showcased exactly what they bring from an offensive perspective as well as a defensive perspective last night. That's such a real asset to Liverpool, isn't it?
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Absolutely. Funny enough, I said the same to Theo last night. There was, I always think of that goal, I think the 21-22 season where against Burnley, where Van Dijk pings it out to Elliot. I think, is it Mane who scores it? I think Liverpool win 2-0. Van Dijk out to Elliot on the right. Elliot plays it into Mane, and it, you know, Liverpool score it with ease. And it kind of always felt that was Liverpool's, you know, best way to bypass the press, wasn't it? It was Van Dijk's ability to just pick a pass out of nowhere. And the reason I said it to Theo is because I actually thought that Joe Gomez's kind of passing has really come on in recent weeks and months. Obviously, he's playing this inverted fullback role. But, I mean, the three of them now, Konate, and to be fair, Quanta as well. So you can mention all four of the lads who can potentially play at centre-half. I think their ball-playing ability has really come on, and we've seen that they're really comfortable getting the ball on the edge of their own box. You know, as I say, we've always known that Van Dijk has had that quality. He's probably been the best ball-playing centre-half probably the Premier League seen in the last 20 years, bar probably Rio Ferdinand. But it kind of seems like the other lads are really learning from him. And you know, when you have got a team like Chelsea who are, you know, last night where, you know, they're trying to sit in and make it difficult, make it awkward. And as I say, you know, you're playing away at Anfield, you're not, you're not a great team. It's a new Chelsea team, isn't it? Under a new manager, you know, you're going to sit in and make it difficult to beat. And that the element of those passes from, as you say, Konate and Van Dijk, it really gave Liverpool an out ball. And in the second half, when, you know, Chelsea were just getting picked apart, weren't they? And as you say, Van Dijk pings it out to Bradley. Bradley takes a touch out his feet. I think he beats that De Sassi and then whips in a wonderful ball for Szoboszlai. And that, you know, it kind of just shows that Liverpool can do it all. They can score the intricate, you know, fine passing move goals where it's, you know, 30 passes, whatnot. They can score the counter-pressing goals where they win it high and wide. But they can also score the goals where it's, you know, almost like a glorified route one, if you want to call it that, where it's, you know, two or three passes and then the ball's in the back of the net. So, yeah, that was another really pleasing aspect. And as I say, it's not just Konate and Van Dijk. I think Gomez as well has been really strong in that department recently.
Yeah, just finally on last night's game then, I'm going to give you a little test. So last night, Conor Bradley was involved in three goals, which means that in the history of the Premier League, only two defenders now aged under the age of 21 have been directly involved in three goals in a game. Who was the other one?
Trent.
It was
Watford
indeed.
5-0.
It was.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that bodes very well, doesn't it, that Liverpool have two defenders, two young defenders capable of bending a game to the will in the way that those two are. But we will move on now from last night's game on to transfer deadline day. Obviously, not been a particularly busy month for Liverpool in terms of incomings. We've had a couple of players going out on loan. What's your thoughts on that? Because I think before Christmas, I sort of would have liked Liverpool to sign a defender. I think, again, what kind of Bradley has done in the last few weeks, and Jarrell Quansah as well, has made me reconsider that a little bit. But do you think Liverpool are well stocked enough to be able to maintain a quadruple charge in the second half of the season?
I think without sounding like a cop out, I think we'll only find out in obviously in the future, won't we? I think the one that does worry me is the Europa League, just because of the kind of the travel that comes with that, and obviously the quick turnarounds, you know, Thursday to Sunday, and you know, on the knockout rounds, they come obviously thick and fast, don't they? But I was kind of similar to you. I think when the summer window closed, I thought Liverpool maybe kind of unnecessarily left themselves a bit short. We know they were looking at someone of like a Levi Colwell, and obviously when he committed to Chelsea, Liverpool didn't really pursue any other, you know, alternative targets, did they? And, you know, we were hearing all these great things about Jarrell Quansah, and we saw him on the preseason tour. And as someone who's watched, like, you know, a lot of academy football over recent years, I was always a big fan of his, but I don't think anyone saw this kind of rise coming in, especially in the short term. But I think because of how unexpected that was to the outside, obviously we know that Klopp was Pep Linders, the whole kind of first team staff were really impressed by Conor Bradley, by Quansah. They kind of had this quiet faith in them, and I think maybe if it was a Champions League, they would have looked at alternative targets, but because it was the Europa League and they probably knew they'd win the group at a canter with minimal force, it was just, you know, the recovery that probably would have been an issue. I think they were probably happy to bed Quansah in and give him that time. And I think he's grown from strength to strength. Obviously, we saw him play, you know, predominantly the home games in Europe and a few of the aways. And then he's kind of transitioned into, you know, League Cup, FA Cup and Premier League. And he's really held his own, you know, whether that be alongside Van Dijk, alongside Joe Gomez, alongside Ibrahim Konate. He's not someone that needs to be led. I think he's a leader. I mean, his debut was against Newcastle with Liverpool 1-0 down. I mean, that just kind of just shows you everything that Jurgen Klopp thinks of him. And he obviously can handle the occasion. But I must say, yeah, back in September, I was a bit thinking unnecessarily short here. It could come back to bite us. But now, I mean, you look at it, you think Liverpool have gone through the really testing December schedule. That was really ruthless, playing on, you know, three or four different fronts. And they had so many players come, you know, out injured. Szoboszlai fell, January was it? Trent at the start of January as well. But now you're looking at it and you think, well, Endo and Salah, you know, she'll be back in the next 2 or 3 weeks, depending on when he returns to full fitness. Obviously, Endo's in the quarterfinals, I think, of the Asia Cup now. So I think the final of that is the 11th of February. So they are starting to get loads of players back. It feels like they've gone through that really testing period where the squad is going to be at its absolute most stretch kind of thing. So in terms of today, transfer deadline day, which is just a normal Thursday, isn't it, for Liverpool now? I'm not really too fussed that they're not bringing anyone in, because I think that the squad is kind of flourishing nicely. We spoke about Alexis McAllister at the top of the show, and I think he's another player who's really grown into his own. And I don't think anyone predicted that he would be Liverpool's starting number six, you know, when he was signed. You look at Wataru Endo, and you look at the kind of reaction when he signed. Everyone was very underwhelmed, and surely this is a smokescreen. There'll be someone else to come through the door, but and there wasn't. And he has taken time, and it, you know, similar to Fabinho when he first came in. But slowly and surely, we've seen why Klopp had that trust in him, and why Klopp said that everyone from the Bundesliga was, you know, congratulating him when he, you know, and Liverpool managed to secure a deal. So I think now, I think Liverpool are in a good place. Obviously, as we've seen 2 or 3 years ago, you know, injuries can come out of nowhere and all it takes is, you know, a torrid turn of luck and all of a sudden you're on the back foot. But I don't think you can plan for a crisis like that. You just have to kind of, you know, deal with it head on. But, you know, I think Liverpool have got, you know, plenty in depth wise. You look at the League Cup final later this month, that'll obviously be your full strength 11. But then after that, it's you know, obviously the FA Cup isn't, the next round will be the 32 and the sixth, mm-hmm. So the quarterfinals is one after that. So it's kind of the business end of the season where you're not looking to rotate as much. You're probably looking to play, barring the Europa League, where you might throw Quansah in, Kelleher in, mm-hmm. you know, Gakpo in, Elliot in. You're mainly looking at now it's going to be your first choice 12 or 13 lads who are going to be starting, you know, near enough every game between now and the end of the season. Because if Liverpool are going to, you know, go toe to toe with Man City, with Arsenal, and whoever else they may come up against in all these competitions, they're going to have to field their best team. And the beauty of that as well is what we have seen this season is even the lads who are maybe 14th or 15th choice are capable of making an impact at that level. You know, someone like Harvey Elliott, who maybe hasn't done enough to kind of start games, you know, when he maybe hasn't justified his starts and impressed as maybe people would think, but coming off the bench, he's been a real game changer for Liverpool. I'm really happy with the kind of the state of Liverpool squad. As I say, things can change, but I think for the meantime, they're as good as golden.
Yeah, I think, like you say, it's so difficult, isn't it? Because one or two injuries and all of a sudden then you start questioning, should we have brought someone in, should we not? But as you say, you can't have a raft of world-class players sat on the bench, yeah, just in case, can you? And there'll be people who argue that, you know, Manchester City in the past might have had that. But even them this season, they've had a pretty small squad to operate with. So it is difficult striking that balance. And I do think last night, Liverpool's squad looked really strong when you consider that the Mo Salah wasn't there, as you say, Endo wasn't there. Ryan Gravenberch doesn't make it onto the pitch. You're bringing those four substitutes on with, what, half an hour to go, 20 minutes to go. So I think the squad does look in pretty rude health at the moment, which is really nice to see. And who knows, they might have signed Mbappe during the time we've been doing this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, I wouldn't hold my breath. Beth, we have got one question from Mickey One More. He said, does Thiago feature in this team for the run-in, or should Endo be given a continued run after the Asia Cup? I mean, I think you know my feelings on Thiago Alcantara. I absolutely adore him. I think he's a wonderful footballer. And I think we all do, to be fair. I don't think anyone disputes that. But, you know, I think his last Liverpool start was a year ago this weekend, which mm-hmm. kind of tells you everything you need to know. He hasn't played a game since April. He was back in training last Friday. So we could potentially see, hopefully, a return to the Liverpool squad in, you know, sometime this month. And, you know, as Mickey says, does he feature in your strongest Liverpool 11?
I think in the near future, no. Sorry, I know that must hurt because I know you are a big Thiago fan, and I am a big Thiago fan. I love him, and I think when he's at his best, then, you know, just purely on paper, of course, he would make it into my strongest Liverpool 11. But I think he's been out for such a long time. The club have been very careful with him. Klopp said last week, even though he's back in training, he does need time. So I can't see him being thrown in at the deep end in the next month or two. Certainly, you know, perhaps if he slowly builds up his minutes, then maybe by the end of March, April. He might be in a run of games where he's able to sort of really make that number six role his own for a little bit, allows McAllister to go a little bit further forward. But then you've got Wataru Endo, who, before he went off to Japan, to international duty with Japan, he was undroppable, really, wasn't he, the form that he was in. So I think in a way that's quite nice, because I don't think there's the necessity for Thiago to be back and in that starting 11.
There's no pressure, is
there? No, as much as there would have been earlier on in the season when McAllister was maybe struggling a little bit. Probably depends on the opposition as well, doesn't it? I think Thiago's ability to pick a pass from deep and really sort of unlock defences is one of his greatest strengths, isn't it? So, you know, if you're up against a side that are maybe sitting deep and you need to, you're looking to break that deadlock, then perhaps that's when Thiago comes into the lineup. I mean, I don't know, what about you? Would you throw him in?
I agree with you. I think, you know, if you are going to sustain a challenge across all fronts, as I say, all the squad is going to be used. But I think, you know, if you're playing a game tomorrow, you know, not say tomorrow, but in 2 or 3 weeks, maybe you wouldn't pick him. And I just don't think at the minute, as you say, you can afford to maybe him be a passenger for those early weeks. I mean, mm-hmm. he's a brilliant footballer, but the last thing you want to do is get so close and his body break down. Sorry. You know, it's kind of, if I'm Jurgen Klopp, I'm similar to you. I'm looking at the calendar and I'm probably circling 5 or 6 fixtures where I can, maybe playing mm-hmm. between now and the end of the season. You're probably thinking of games at Old Trafford where you want to go toe-to-toe, where Liverpool, you know, historically struggle to keep the ball if you kind of ignore the last couple couple of results there. You know, we struggled to keep the ball and you know, maybe play the occasion instead of actually playing the United team that's up against them. I think Thiago will be really good in a game like that. I think we saw it a few years ago in the running where he had a similar, obviously it wasn't as long as of an absence, but he missed quite a lot of football over Christmas with this hip injury, and he came back. And I mean, I always say that he was the reason Liverpool went within a whisker of, you know, a quadruple that it would have been that season. I always think that those two games against City, the one at the Etihad, the 2-2, similar to Old Trafford, I think his ball retention for Liverpool that day was absolutely unbelievable. And then I think 2 weeks later when they played City at Wembley, and I mean, Fabinho, Thiago and Keita, I think, started the afternoon, and I still think it's probably the best 45 minutes of the Jurgen Klopp era, you know, whatever is to come over the next 4 or 5 months. But yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? It feels like previously there has been such a huge pressure and a huge weight on his shoulders, because, you know, you look at the midfield he was coming into, it was the likes of Oxlade-Chamberlain, who was unreliable himself fitness-wise, Keita too. Then you had Henderson, who was clearly past his best, and you had Milner, who was a utility man, but obviously being made, you know, being used more because of the injuries. And then you kind of had Curtis Jones and Harvey Elliott, who weren't quite fully fledged yet, and they were kind of still learning their trade. Obviously, Jones suffered with his own injuries. So it kind of felt like Thiago was your one man who you were just saying, right, he's fit, he can put, you know, 4 or 5 passes together, let's go out and kind of wheel him out. And that's kind of, I think, why his body broke down. But between now and the end of the season, as you've touched on with McAllister, with Endo, the kind of the possibilities are, pardon the pun, Endo, aren't they? So I think if you can kind of find a happy medium and slot Thiago in there, I think it'll be a really nice balance. And, you know, if you are playing an FA Cup final, or you need to win the, you know, Wolves at home on the final game of the season, whatnot, I mean, Thiago, I think, goes into your best team.
Yeah, definitely. And it would be lovely to see him play in this midfield, wouldn't it, with Alexis McAllister, with Dominic Szoboszlai, with Curtis Jones as well playing in the way that he has been playing lately. So fingers crossed that he will play some part, even if it's a small part, before the end of the season. We'll move on now to potential Jurgen Klopp replacements. As I said at the top of the show, it's a really big job. I don't envy whoever has to take it on.
You say that Jurgen Klopp replacements, does it? It's wild.
It is wild. And I'm not sure that there is someone out there who is worthy almost of coming in and taking the job, but someone will have to do it. My personal favourite, I've got to say, would be Xabi Alonso. And, you know, I know it is a huge risk, isn't it? You know, employing a former player as manager. We've seen, you know, what Frank Lampard did at Chelsea. It didn't obviously quite work out for him there. Even, you know, Solskjaer at Manchester United, it was a bit of an erratic period for the club during his time there. So it is a risk, and there's always a certain romanticism that comes with it. But I just think he's doing so well. You know, don't forget, he's 28 games unbeaten in all competitions by Leverkusen. They're the only team in Europe's top 5 leagues to have achieved that. The way that they're playing, I think it's only Bayern and Stuttgart who have a higher XG, which I know, again, XG is one of those stats that some people love, some people hate, but it just showcases the type of football that he's got them playing. I think close to 60% possession on average as well. So I think the style, even though he plays in sort of most of the time at a 3-4-2-1, so a slightly different formation to maybe what Liverpool are used to, but that sort of the way that he puts an emphasis on it on his wide players and pace out wide, which Liverpool have in abundance, I think could really suit them. And I also think that, you know, the charisma that he has as well, because I think replacing Jurgen Klopp in that sense is almost as difficult in the tactical sense. I think he could be a good fit. And there was a quote the other day from Leverkusen's sporting director, Simon Rolfs, and he said that Alonso had instilled a sense of seriousness and maturity in Leverkusen's football. And I think that bodes very well for him going forward as a manager, because I think that's something that Jurgen Klopp has done, and we've seen that evolution, especially this season, actually, to go from a side that, you know, were maybe sort of this heavy metal counter-attacking side to now a side that does enjoy a lot of possession, a side that does, you know, like to pass through midfield and have a maturity about them. So I think that's why I think Alonso could be a good fit.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's no going to be no easy feat, is it, for whoever does come in? And I think it's really difficult, because when you think of someone who would replace Jurgen Klopp, you wouldn't assume it would be at the top of English football. You almost assume that Liverpool needs to be they need another rebuild job. But Klopp's almost done that job already, and that's kind of why he's leaving, because of, you know, he said last week that, and the squad was in kind of capable hands and capable control, that he didn't feel the need to take it on, you know, for the kind of the remaining 2 years of his contract, which is completely fair enough, because I think, you know, if you buy into probably year two of the rebuild, then you've probably got to buy into years 4, 5, 6, you know, and so on. So I think to leave now is, yes, why does it hurt? But I think if you strip it down and look at it at face value and kind of look at the rationale of his decision, I think it does make sense. In terms of Alonso, it's difficult because his sample size is so small. I mean, mm-hmm. he only took over Leverkusen October 2022, wasn't it? So it's not even 2 years of management yet. But I think, as you say, Beth, the kind of the authority that he stamped on Leverkusen, I mean, this was a side that would, you know, I think they were in the relegation zone of the Bundesliga at the time, and to kind of flip the club on its head, and think they got to the Conference League semi-finals last year. Sorry, the Europa League semi-finals last year, knocked out to Jose Mourinho's Roma. So no shame in losing to him in that regard. But yeah, I mean, there's ways to kind of impress, isn't there? And I think the style of football that he's playing is certainly what's caught the attentions kind of over here in England. He was obviously linked with the Tottenham job earlier in the summer before Postecoglou. So it's not just Liverpool that are looking at this former player and thinking, oh, you know, he understands the club, he might be a good manager, we'll chance it. You know, Tottenham, you know, obviously considered him, and obviously that wasn't to be, what, for whatever reasons. But I think that the two main ones are probably De Zerbi and Alonso. I think that at the moment, everyone's for front runners, and there'll be other people, I'm sure, like the likes of Thomas Frank, who have done good jobs at Brentford. I've seen his name floated about. But I think if you were a betting man to put your money on, it'd be one of those. I think, as you say, Beth, I think someone who's going to get the buy-in from the crowd is important, because whilst this squad is young and it's shown, you know, real signs of promise, you know, there's every chance they could be starting next season as, you know, FA Cup holders, League Cup holders, Premier League holders, and, you know, going into the Champions League as Europa League winners. So there's enormous expectation on that, and with that, you know, if you even go two or three games without a win, or you only win four of your first 10, say, you just go through a sticky patch. I think if you have someone like De Zerbi, who's obviously alien to Liverpool, he has no connection, no buy-in, and that's not to say that Liverpool fans would turn on him instantly. I think they would understand that. You know, that was kind of the early years of Klopp, wasn't it? You'd beat. Yeah. I always remember they beat Man City 4-1 at Anfield, you know, as recently as 2018, and then lost 1-0 at Swansea the week after. So that was kind of the Jekyll and Hyde nature of it. But I think because you could see the bigger picture, he was, you know, infectious, charismatic, it's easy to buy into it. I just think with someone like De Zerbi, maybe you don't have that. But with Alonso, he's someone who understands the club. Obviously, he was adored by the Cop, adored by Liverpool fans. And I just think he has that aura. I mean, this is a player who's won, you know, three or four Champions Leagues. He's won the World Cup. He might not have the biggest kind of managerial CV, and he probably hasn't got the experience that De Zerbi's had working up, you know, through the leagues in Italy. I think as kind of a young player, you know, you look at the kind of squad, you know, the ages of, you know, 18 to 24, they all know what Alonso was as a player. They'll all respect him. I'm sure the likes of Harvey Elliott and Curtis Jones will have idolised him at some point during, you know, their time as Liverpool supporters. So I think that in its own kind of commands its own respect and brings its own authority. And I as you say, those comments from the sporting director there, and kind of how he goes about his business, and kind of the image he kind of has at the club, I think that tells you everything. But from a tactical point of view, it will be a different style to what Liverpool are used to. I think, was it a 3-4-2-1 you said that to play? So obviously Liverpool haven't played a back three since the back end of Brendan Rodgers' time, which, you know, the days of Emre Can and those kind of players, Kolo Touré, Martin Skrtel. So it would be a completely different blueprint, I suppose, with that. You know, if it's a 3 or a 5, whatever you want to call it, there is obviously huge emphasis on, you know, wing backs, full backs. So you know, we talked about Conor Bradley, we talked about Trent Alexander-Arnold, we talked about Andy Robertson, and you've got Kostas Tsimikas as well. So you've got a real kind of excellence of full backs there, whatever the occasion. You throw Joe Gomez in as a makeshift full back as well. You've kind of got full backs for any occasion, you know, the Premier League kind of may present. Stylistically, I don't know if it would be. I mean, I know Jurgen Klopp's kind of adapted throughout his Liverpool career, as you say. When he first came in, it was a bit kind of erratic, heavy metal football, chaos, organised chaos probably is a kind of term. Obviously, over the years, I think they've, especially the 1920 season was the first year I really noticed that they were a bit more controlled, a bit more composed, you know, a bit more happier to have a lion's share of the possession rather than, as you say, playing on the counter-attack with, you know, flying, you know, Salah and Mane. I do wonder if this Alonso ball maybe a bit slower, a bit more, you know, build up from deep, similar to De Zerbi, really. Yes, you're looking to press in high areas, but it is all about, you know, splitting the fullbacks and kind of playing with your six, bouncing it off your six and then moving up. From kind of the videos and clips I've seen of Alonso's Leverkusen this season, as you say, it is overloads with you know, fullbacks pushing up high. I mean, they've got Jeremy Frimpong there at the minute, and they've got Hincapié, who has been linked with Liverpool as well in the past. So they have got, you know, really good players to do those roles. It's just whether you could implement something like that and go for such a change at Liverpool after kind of what they've been used to. But I think, whoever does come in, it's going to be a huge change to what Klopp has been playing, because I think Klopp's philosophy is representative of his personality. And I think you'll find that with most managers. So, you know, it's not going to be another Jurgen Klopp. And I don't think we should try and look for another Jurgen Klopp. No. I think maybe, you know, the next manager that comes in should be, you know, Xabi Alonso, you know, his own version of himself. He shouldn't try and play to what he thinks people want him to be or what he should be. And that may be ripping up the blueprint and saying, right, you know, I've got this young squad, they're young enough to be moulded. You know, this is going to be my way. I'm going to define a generation in the same way Klopp did. So I certainly don't think his play style, well, as I say, I don't think his play style is kind of suited to this Liverpool squad at the minute, but that's not to say it couldn't work.
The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo. The Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Yeah, and I think, of course, you know, we say there his Leverkusen side tends to be a 3-4-2-1, but that's not to say that he's going to, you know, follow that mould at Liverpool. You know, it's all about the players that you have at your disposal, isn't it? And I think one thing about Alonso that, you know, from reading a little bit is that he's not massively married to sort of one stylistic philosophy. And I saw a quote that he values winning above all else, which I think would go down very well at Liverpool. And, you know, so perhaps, you know, when he sees the players that he does have at Anfield, if indeed he does come here, then he might, you know, alter that formation. He might not particularly stick with the 3-4-2-1.
I suppose it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it, playing with Liverpool? You know, as I say, there's every chance they go into this having won every competition this season. You know, it's completely different to playing against Leverkusen, who I know have had their kind of financial problems, you know, when you're trying to compete against the likes of, you know, Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund, RB Leipzig. So it's certainly, he'd be with one of the heavyweights of the league rather than looking to kind of punch up with the plucky underdog. So as you said, that could completely change his style.
Yeah, I mean, we've touched a little bit on De Zerbi. I mean, I was reading something that Pep Guardiola said about him not too long ago. His teams play Michelin star football, and he's one of the most influential coaches in the last 20 years. Now, I do always think Pep hams it up a little bit when he's talking about an opponent, but high praise indeed, and there obviously is some truth in that. And he was, you know, earlier in the season, I think, you know, the way Brighton got through the Europa League group, obviously the first time playing in Europe, so that was an incredible feat last season. There was so much to admire about them. I think Liverpool bore the brunt of a couple of their best performances of the season, but they were obviously on the receiving end of a 4-0 defeat at Luton Town earlier in the week. Now, of course, you can have bad days at the office, and they have had, it's worth noting, a pretty bad injury crisis of late, but they have actually only won 3 of their last 16 games. I mean, is that the form of a Liverpool manager?
It's not, and I saw that stat do the round the other night. It's actually, I wasn't aware of the wider context to it. Yeah, I knew they hadn't been on a great one of form. I think it was only 1-5 prior to the game against Luton. I didn't realise how disastrous the run was, because I think they've done really well in the Europa League. They had a tough group. I think they had Ajax, Marseille, and another Greek side, I can't remember. But, you know, they qualified out of that group automatically. So they got the bye into the round of 32. So there is a lot of kind of caveats to Brighton's performance this season. You also factor in that they've lost McAllister, they've lost Caicedo, you know, they've lost the goalkeeper Sanchez to Chelsea. And then obviously if you extend it further back, you know, who Brighton have lost over the last 2 or 3 years, it's a club constantly in transition. So I feel as a manager, it would be quite hard to, yes, you've got to take the rough with the smooth, but it feels like it would be quite hard to kind of plan and almost build a legacy at that club. And I'm sure, you know, he'll have ideas and plans to do that. I mean, you touched on it there last season. He qualified them to Europe for the first time, an FA Cup semi-final defeat to United. So, you know, certainly if you look at how the season started, losing Graham Potter so early, and you recovered it. I mean, his first game was that 3-3 at Anfield, which was, I don't think anyone knew much about De Zerbi prior to that. And then he came and really announced himself to the Premier League. They are obviously 8th at the moment, so they're not as punching as high as they were last season. But as I say, there's loads of caveats to that. Yeah, I mean, stylistically, again, De Zerbi's another one who likes to play from deeper. I think there's a lot of emphasis on the centre halves, and kind of just reading a few things from kind of Brighton websites and people who, you know, watch Brighton far more often than I do. And it's, De Zerbi does this thing with his centre halves where he basically encourages them to put their foot on the ball, which is to kind of compare it to like futsal and what you do in that kind of game to kind of entice the opposition and then into pressing, and then he just looks to bypass that with, you know, passing between the lines, breaking the lines, and breaking quickly, and that's where they have
something that you feel like could suit the personnel, yeah, that Liverpool have.
Yeah, especially,
it?
You think the front line. I mean, they've got Matoma and Pedro up there. They've got Solly March and those kind of players, but they've got quick players, and they've got players who can, you know, break you know, really fast in transition, and Liverpool have got that. You know, maybe Salah isn't as fast as he once was, but he's certainly no slouch. They've obviously got Luis Diaz, they've got Diogo Jota, so they have got players who can kind of go back to front, and I think we saw that last night. I mean, you look at Conor Bradley's goal with, I think Diaz, Jota wins it, and then I think it goes back to Luis Diaz and he plays it through to Bradley. I mean, I'm sure that came from a Chelsea turnover in possession, so it's kind of going back to front like that when Chelsea have, not Chelsea, but a team have committed players high and wide up the field. But I think everyone now, I mean, we've got a few comments in here saying that, you know, people are favouring Alonso and he's the only real candidate. Someone says, I like De Zerbi, he doesn't have a good squad at Brighton. With our players, he could possibly do the business. I mean, that's an interesting point. As I say, Brighton are always in transition. They probably always know that they're probably the bottom of the food chain at the Premier League at the minute. And all eyes are kind of on them because of how they've recruited and people are, you know, looking to snap up their next prospects. Again, he certainly wouldn't have that at Liverpool. He'll be, you know, at the top of the food chain. But I think the pleasing thing with De Zerbi that I do like, and it's similar to Klopp, which I can't comment on whether Alonso has done it extensively. He probably hasn't had enough time to, but you look at the players De Zerbi's worked with and he's always improved him. So you look at Shakhtar, his big one was Mudryk, and he ends up going to Chelsea for 60-70 million quid last January. And a lot of, I mean, I know Chelsea probably massively overpaid for him, but a lot of that was down to the time that they kind of had at Shakhtar. Obviously before the kind of conflict with Russia and that league got halted, but he was kind of a real bright spark. I remember there was one game in particular at the Bernabeu. I can't remember if they drew or they lost last minute, but Mudryk got a standing ovation. So that kind of shows that the levels he was able to reach under De Zerbi. And then you've got players like Trossard, who, okay, didn't have a real long stay under De Zerbi, but they improved. He got a move to Arsenal. Then you look at McAllister. He spoke lowly of him recently, and then Caicedo as well. So there's players that De Zerbi has kind of followed with the Brighton model, where he's bought for cheap and turned them over. And I just think when you look at the kind of constraints that Liverpool work under sometimes under Fenway Sports Group, you know, they can't go, you know, pound for pound with Manchester City in the transfer market. It is sometimes about taking a step back and looking at maybe the second rate market and thinking, you know, can we get a Ryan Gravenberch for 25 million? Can we then transform him into, say, a 60, 70 million pound midfielder? And I think De Zerbi, his track record so far would suggest he can do that. So I think that's a massive tick in his box. But I think it then goes back to the whole kind of loving with Alonso. I think that is kind of, I know football, you shouldn't mix football and emotion at times, and you should try and separate the two, but it is kind of quite hard to overlook Alonso, isn't it, Beth?
Yeah, I do, that, like I say, I do think he is the outstanding candidate for the job, even though De Zerbi does probably have a bigger body of, well, he definitely does have a bigger body of work to look at. I think that's a really good point, actually, about Mudryk, because I think, you know, he obviously missed an absolute sitter last night, didn't he? But there was a reason that Chelsea paid so highly for him. There's a reason that Arsenal were in for him, and that's because of his form at Shakhtar, and De Zerbi played a huge part in that. So credit to him for that. I think that the way that he plays, obviously, again, that sort of high pressing, the emphasis on quick passing, on overloading the opposition box, all of those things that you can sort of associate with the Jurgen Klopp team, really. You know, they've played, his Brighton side have played 4-3-3 quite a lot as well, which again is perhaps positionally more suited to Liverpool than what Alonso can bring. So I think there's a lot of positives to take from De Zerbi, and certainly until I heard that stat, that slightly concerning stat, yeah, about the 3-16 wins.
But I think there's always context and stuff like that, and I think especially when you know, people like us who don't follow Brighton as closely as we would say Liverpool, I think it's quite easy sometimes to get caught up in that and look at it maybe just as for what it is without, you know, contextualizing it and maybe looking at how well Brighton have done in the Europa League or what they've kind of had to balance with this season.
Yeah, I do think that the one concern with taking a manager from Brighton, and Brighton get a lot of praise and rightly so for what they do in the transfer market in terms of bringing players in, and I think for players that come in there, I think sometimes it gets levelled at clubs like Liverpool and Manchester City and Chelsea. Why don't they take more risks in the same way that Brighton do? But I think when you play for a club like Liverpool, there's a certain expectation that you come in and you do the business straight away. And if you have a couple of bad games, then that's you're out of the starting lineup. I think at Brighton, it's a different story because, you know, we hear all of these names of players that they've bought for not a lot of money. Caicedo, obviously, prime example, who go on and then become these sort of £100 million players. But there's also probably within their ranks a number of players who've come in for not an awful lot of money who maybe haven't delivered or take a little bit of time to deliver, and would they get that time at Liverpool? And I think from a managerial standpoint, it's probably the same thing. You know, that sort of form, 3 wins in 16, would just not fly at Liverpool. No. So that is my one concern. But another contender, just finally, is from Sporting, Ruben Amorim. So just give us a little bit of a rundown on him and why he's been linked with the job.
Well, I mean, his kind of career to date is really interesting. So he's only actually currently 39. He's managing Sporting Lisbon. And basically, before the pandemic, Sporting were really kind of strapped for cash. And Ruben Amorim had been a coach for 10 weeks at Braga. And just before the pandemic, so in March 2020, Sporting paid £10 million, a release clause to Braga to bring Amorim onto the club. And it was a really strange decision at the time. I was reading kind of some articles from that period, and they were all saying, you know, Sporting don't have money for players. You know, they're a selling team. Why are they spending so much on a manager who's had, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks experience? But essentially, you know, the following season after that, he ends Sporting's 19-year wait for a league title. And funny enough, actually, the job before he was at Braga, he didn't even have the correct coaching qualifications. So the team that were in the third division had a 6-point deduction. So I think it was suspended in the end, because kind of similar to the lad at Rennes at the minute, Will Still, he wasn't qualified to kind of coach these games. So he left, and then he goes to Braga, then he goes to Sporting Lisbon. And since then, he's just done miracles. He plays a 3-4-3. And funny enough, at the heart of his defence is Sebastián Coates, so a former Liverpool defender. But he's done really well in Europe. And as I say, he won the Milita title. So he's another one who has been tentatively linked. I'm not sure how strong those links are. But I think Tottenham were linked with him in the summer, one after the Conte era. It feels maybe like someone is waiting for someone in kind of a bigger European league to take a risk on him. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, so I don't know if Liverpool will be his next job, but maybe it feels like someone in Spain should take a risk on him first. And then, you know, you maybe look at him going to the Premier League, or, you know, if De Zerbi goes, does he go to a Brighton or someone like that, somewhere you maybe can play around with it a bit. But he certainly has he's a similar age to obviously Alonso, so it's a really interesting one. He doesn't have a huge body of work, but from reading about him and watching a few videos, his pedigree of what he's done so far is really interesting.
Yeah, I think experience wise, like you say, it's probably a similar ilk to Alonso, isn't it? And I think that's the reason I'd be more inclined to take that risk on Alonso, is because of his relationship with Liverpool, because I just think that will automatically buy you a little bit more time and maybe command a little bit more respect in terms of players that you're able to attract to the club, because we know how many players come out and say that Jurgen Klopp was the reason that they came to Liverpool. So you want someone of a similar standing, I guess, within the game to be able to attract players to the club. But I suppose only time will tell. Before all of that, though, we do have the small matter of a league title, a quadruple perhaps, to be won. Over the next few weeks, some really big games, and we'll be back in it in a couple of weeks' time.
Fortnightly, I think, is the plan, isn't it?
So we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time to dissect. Obviously, we'll have got the Arsenal game this weekend, some other big games coming up as well. But thank you very much for listening to Analysing Anfield.
You've been listening to the Blood Red Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.